The 100 Years' War, 1360 to 1364. The Great Company, Part 2. This will eventually become the White Company, but for now we'll keep it as the Great Company. Now, after their success last time, resistance, such as it was organized by the Pope in Avignon. Papal palace was a scene of hysterical activity. Men were set to work on the walls and the ditches, which were still incomplete and in bad condition. The city's food supply, which came mainly from the river, was interrupted and its dense population threatened with starvation. The captain, an Aragonese nobleman, was summoned urgently back from his native country. Soldiers were hired in France and neighboring countries. Appeals for help was dispatched to the kings of France and Aragon, the Duke of Burgundy, the Count of Savoy, and 72 cities of Western Europe. At the end of January 1361, the Pope publicly excommunicated the soldiers of the Great Company and proclaimed a crusade against them. It was a complete failure. The cardinal appointed to organize it set up his headquarters at Bagnols and waited for men to come to his colors. A few turned up under the impression that they would be paid, most of whom withdrew when they discovered that only indulgences were to be offered, not money. The appeals to neighboring princes proved more effective. The King of Aragon promised 1,800 men, several hundred of whom actually appeared. John II sent the Constable of France, Robert Fiennes, and the Marshal Arnoux Ardheim to the Lower Rhine in February 1361. Between them, they briefly checked the operation of the invaders. The Great Company was becoming too large and too concentrated to feed itself. Faced with an increasingly organized defense, they sued for peace. In March of 1361, they made a treaty with the representatives of the Pope and another with the Constable of France. They were offered comprehensive indemnities. In return, they promised to go away. But where would they go? Everyone appreciated that they would have to be found employment killing people somewhere else. So in the course of the next few weeks, a series of rather complicated arrangements were made to use some of them in Italy and others in Spain. Now, in 14th century Italy was an inviting country for professional mercenaries. Now, they would call them condottieri. The cities were richer than those of France, and their trade more extensive and vulnerable. There was no dominant power. The perennial wars of the northern cities, the territorial ambitions of the Visconti rulers of Milan, and the unending struggle of successive papal vicars to control the papal state in central Italy had created anarchic conditions very similar to those in which the companies had flourished in France. For many years, the wars of the Italian peninsula had been fought by armies of soldiers of fortune recruited by contract captains. Many of these were foreigners, mainly Germans and Hungarians. Most were in the service of the Pope's enemies. They included the most powerful of them all, the great company of the German captain Conrad of Landau, who served the Visconti. Italy had hitherto been untouched by the wars of England and France, except during the brief period when the Genoese had supplied contract fleets to Philip VI. It was now to become, like Scotland, the Low Countries, Provence, and later Spain, one of the countries on the periphery, the Anglo-French Wars, which experienced the reflected violence of the main protagonists. It was Pope Innocent VI who arranged the departure of part of the great company of Pont Saint-Esprit across the Alps. He saw in them a weapon that could be used against the Visconti and their German auxiliaries in the Piedmont and Lombardy. He struck a deal with the Marquis de Montferrat, a prominent Piedmontese nobleman, and like Innocent himself, an enemy of the Visconti. Montferrat agreed to lead the routiers in the Piedmont. Once there, they would be hired for an initial period of 2 months by the Pope's formidable vicar general in Italy, the Castilian Cardinal Gilles Abrenos. A large subsidy, said to have been 100,000 florins, was paid to the Marquis for his service. Another 30,000 florins was paid to the companies themselves. The cost of the whole venture was shared between the papal chamber and the city of Genoa, then the leading Guelph power in northern Italy. A large number of captains at Pont Saint-Esprit were signed up for this scheme. They formed themselves into a new company, which became known as the White Company, whose combined strength was reported to be about 6,000 men. They included all the Germans and most of the English companies who had been operating in eastern France. Their leader was an English-speaking German called Albert Stairs, who was probably the same person as Albrecht, the notorious captain of Guy Sursin. After much delay, occasioned by the difficulty of collecting the money for their fees and wages, the White Company eventually left Provence at the end of May 1361. In June, they appeared in Italy. Surviving accounts of the operations of the companies in France were written by men whom such sights were by now too familiar for detailed notice. They are sparse by comparison with Italian sources of the 1360s, which have all the freshness and detail of surprise. They refer to the invaders indiscriminately as English, and although only a minority of them were in fact native Englishmen, it was these who made the greatest impact. They were all young men, Filippo Villani wrote, bred in the long wars of England and France, fierce, enthusiastic, quite used to the routine of killing and looting. The White Company, like the Great Company in France, was a coalition of different units under their own captains, employing the methods and the organization which English armies had perfected in France. It was governed by a captain general, a council representing the main contingent, and a hierarchy of constables, marshals, sub-marshals, and corporals. The single-mindedness and discipline of these men astonished the Italians. They were indifferent to their own comfort. They marched through the night. They fought in the winter and summer alike in a country where warfare had traditionally been just a seasonal activity. Their equipment was quite unlike that of the existing armies in Italy. They wore light armor, often no more than a leather doublet or metal breastplate, with a thigh piece, leg armor, and unvisored bassinet. Their cavalry dismounted to fight on foot. They formed themselves up in units or lances of three, which advanced on the enemy on foot, holding their lance between them. Their archers used huge bows of yew, which they could hold from their head to the ground and from where they could shoot long arrows. They used specially constructed scaling ladders, which were assembled in sections, each one fitting onto the top of the one below. But what was the most shocking about the White Company, even to communities that had grown used to the German companies of the 1340s and 1350s, was its brutality. They set new standards of savagery in war. They wreaked appalling and systematic destruction in the countryside of Piedmont and Lombardy. They burnt to the ground open villages and captured towns. They tortured prisoners who would not make ransom agreements and murdered those who could not. The White Company remained for 2 years in the service of the church in Italy. During this period, they briefly transformed the balance of power in Lombardy, inflicted terrible damage on the territory of Milan, and virtually destroyed the Great Company of Conrad of Landau. But like other associations of its kind, the White Company was inherently unstable. It was divided by the ambitions and rivalries of its captains, and by the language and habits of the two main national groups of which it was composed. Its losses were severe. Men died in battle or were culled by disease. Bubonic plague, which was endemic in the towns of northern Italy, claimed many lives. These losses were difficult to replace. The Germans could recruit from their fellow countrymen already in Italy, but the English had only a trickle of new arrivals from Gascony and England to maintain their numbers. They remained the most disciplined and effective part of the White Company. But 3 years after their initial arrival in Italy, there were only about 800 of them left, perhaps a fifth of the company's total strength. So we'll be looking at the White Companies as they go into Italy, and then, of course, we'll probably eventually end up back in France. The wars in Italy, particularly later in the 1500s, will become less destructive. The Italians realized that, you know, they're all individual city-states, and they had X amount of territory, and that was how they kept their finances together. So when they recruited condottieri armies, they were later instructed to fight in non-economic areas and not destroy everything. And of course, then we start getting into the time period where you try to bribe the other commander to switch sides, and a real interesting situation later on in the Italian Wars. At any rate, the sources for this, with the Hundred Years' War, is, of course, Froissart's Chronicles, the Hundred Years' War by Perrault, the Hundred Years' War by Nylands, and the Hundred Years' War, Volume 2, Trial by Fire by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.